Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. First of all, Happy New Year to all. I hope that each of you will find a way to make this the best years of your life, or the best year of your life, with more to come. It's not going to be an easy year, I'm sure, but it's so important to remember to be grateful for what we have and to be forgiving as well. When we're forgiving, we give up enmity and anger and resentment, and we try to find those resources of love and caring in ourselves. It doesn't make us more vulnerable. It actually makes us happier and more effective in our lives. I have a new blog up on Huffington Post, just went up an hour or two ago, about forgiveness. Also, don't forget that on my website, Bregan.com, Bregin.com, I have a new free video series called Simple Truths About Psychiatry. It is attracting literally thousands of viewers, and you can get to it real easy. They're short videos on key issues in psychiatry, like do you have a biochemical imbalance and how do psychiatric drugs really work and other such vital topics. My guest today is a friend, a colleague, and a really good man, Michael Gilbert. Michael is a school psychologist in Syracuse, New York, in the public school system. He also has a private practice in Syracuse, New York. He's also the founder of It's All About Children and Families, which is certainly a theme of my work. He's been doing other activities that he might want to share with you. Michael, are you there?
I am. Hello, Peter.
Hi, Michael. Well, just before going further, I want to introduce one more thing about you that is so remarkable. I've known Michael for many years now. I worked with him in my old organization, and I've worked with him in my new organization. And Michael is one of the few people I know in the what we might loosely call the psychiatric reform movement. It really should be more positive. That is the best of psychiatry and psychology movement. And Michael does service all the time. He helps out at conferences. He runs a bookstore at the conferences. He plans conferences. He gives lectures. He invites people into Syracuse to lecture. And he does all of this, as far as I can tell, without getting rich and maybe without even getting compensation. He's a generous man who really works for the good of us human beings. And I mean that from the bottom of my heart, Michael. Welcome on to the show.
Thank you, Peter.
Where would you like to start? Don't mean to put you on the spot, but you could start by telling us about It's All About Children and Family.
Yeah, It's About Children and Family is a nonprofit organization here in the Syracuse, New York area. And
is it Childhood and Family? Did I missay it?
It's About Childhood and Family. But
I said Children and Family. It's About Childhood and Family.
Yeah, it's same idea though. And really, our mission here locally is to try to better inform, you know, parents first of all about mental health disorders and what they really mean for their families and for their kids, to give them more accurate information, to really give them what they need to make an informed decision, which most of our parents nationally don't often get. So we try to make that a big part of what we do. And that also extends into the schools, trying to really educate teachers and social workers and school psychologists about, you know, what the medical model is about and what it looks like, and you know, different alternative perspectives to kids' behaviors, and why they, you know, what the challenges, you know, may be stemming from, and other ways to respond to them, as opposed to just a label, a diagnosis, and you know, often medication. So a lot of the work that we do is really trying to better inform people about, you know, what's going on with kids and their behavior, and other ways that they might address that that are really safer and more effective. And as you said, we, you know, we do a lot of seminars and workshops. We bring people in from all over the country to do workshops, and we do conferences as well. And so really trying to, you know, build a network, at least within my region, of people who are, you know, much better informed about what's going on with kids and families today. And that, you know, that also includes, you know, ADHD is a very popular diagnosis with kids, especially in the school setting. And so really kind of unraveling that disorder and what some of the finer points are and what they really mean in terms of what's going on with the kids, and trying to explain it in a different way for parents so that they, you know, understand it from a different perspective, and then can, you know, maybe see it in a different way, and can see it as something that they can help overcome without using medication. Because as you know, Peter, I mean, what we're seeing today is a lot of our kids are, you know, now being diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And so often that's, you know, coming out of kids who were initially diagnosed with ADHD or oppositional defiant disorder, all, you know, one of those behavioral disorders. So really trying to help people better understand that, so that our initial reaction isn't just we need to get these kids on medication. Because, you know, a lot of people want to be helpful, and they think that if they just can get the family into the traditional mental health system, that that'll take care of a lot of things. But often that often just contributes, you know, to more difficulty, because they're given, you know, inaccurate information, and often just given a perception that, you know, their kid needs medication and probably needs medication for the rest of their lives. So, you know, we're trying to correct some of those misperceptions.
What do you feel children and families need when they have a kid who is distressed or distressing in some way?
Well, the way I handle that, and again, most of the families that we work with are coming from the inner city, so we have some common things that come up. But you know, when I sit down with families, I like to really first, you know, after explaining to them, you know, that their child doesn't have a chemical imbalance, that there's nothing, you know, nothing in terms of the ADHD or oppositional defiant label being a, you know, it's more of a label that describes a cluster of behaviors. And then we kind of talk about, you know, why those behaviors might be currently exhibited by their kids to the point where they're, you know, concerned about it. And so, for example, if it's something like ADHD, I try to, you know, go through a number of things and rule them out with the family. And again, first you have to really make a connection with the family to let them know that you want to work with them and you're working with them together, and, you know, you want to collaborate with them and that they're part of the solution. And so we'll go through some things as we get more information about, for example, we want to rule out things like, you know, what are their sleep patterns like? You know, how much are they, you know, some of the simple things, you know, first, you know, in terms of sleep and nutrition and physical activity, making sure those things are in balance, because there certainly are studies that indicate that kids who are having, you know, poor sleep, you know, often exhibit behaviors that can get diagnosed as ADHD, or if they're not getting enough good physical activity, you know, having some good structure and routine. So just, you know, really looking at some of the basic stuff like that. Or, you know, if they have a family history of certain autoimmune things, we might have them consult with their, you know, pediatrician to, you know, rule out any of those kind of things or allergies. But then we talk, you know, more about, you know, again, some of the functions of the behavior. for example, one of the big things that I see in Syracuse is kids who are coming from very stressful home environments. And the stressful environments could be for a variety of reasons. It could be the family, there's family conflict, or it's a one-parent home, and that one parent's trying to, work two or sometimes three jobs to support the family, so they're often not there. And so maybe it's a sibling who's trying to, help raise the kids, or it's a grandparent. But you see a lot of stress. And one of the things that we know about stress is that kids who are exposed to stress, often it impairs some of their what they call in the school systems is executive function skills, and those include things like working memory and attention and cognitive flexibility. So those kids who have are growing up in those stressful environments, have difficulty sitting in a classroom all day as they're expected to do. And so they present with some challenges at school. But one of the things that's happening in education, and this is probably some conversation for later in this discussion, is often our schools are now creating classroom environments that are very stressful because there's so much testing and so much pressure to do well on standardized testing, and we want to push kids along so much quicker than some kids are ready to handle. And so those environments can also be very stressful, which is just adding, again, to the child's, stress level. So, again, they're having a difficult time, managing their emotions or maintaining their attention. And what we do in public schools is we want to, target that behavior as something wrong with the child in terms of they have attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And what schools need to, what schools typically do with that, thought is that they, refer parents to their pediatrician for further evaluation. And as you know, and a lot of people know, there's no real evaluation for ADHD. There's no test. It's based on some subjective, checklist. And, if a teacher is, observing a child as being inattentive and impulsive, and they're giving a checklist that asks them, is the child impulsive and inattentive, then of course they're going to look like they meet the criteria for ADHD. And often they meet the DSM criteria for ADHD, but, what does that really mean? And so that's what, we try to explain to the family. So, part of it is working with the family in terms of what kind of stressors may be, going on that, maybe contributing to the difficulty that's going on with the child and individually, but also with the family unit, and see if there's ways that we can reduce that stress in terms of maybe helping, connect them with other resources in the community, or, developing some, structure and routine within the home. And the other thing that we really, stress a lot is just providing a lot of nurturing relationship building, with their kids and their family. Because again, a lot of that can be can help overcome some of the things that are going on if they can really, provide some nurturing, time with their kids, and some loving and and really thoughtful time with their kids. I mean, that can go a long way to helping, those kids really develop some of the skills they need, to be successful.
You are working with such difficult situations, families and children. I admire you doing that. It's certainly a challenge. It must be kind of heartbreaking because I imagine it's not easy to engage, especially when you're the school psychologist, rather than, say, working through your nonprofit. I mean, just... you must have great difficulty engaging the parents, even though they're key to the whole success of their children. Is that the case?
Right. Well, it is often the case. I mean, we, sometimes are faced with, how can we best help this child, knowing that we may not have the, support of the parent that we really need. And so, when I'm within the school setting, I try to find ways that I can really, help that child develop some of those what we call social-emotional learning skills, those skills that help them with their, you know, self-awareness, their empathy, their ability to handle frustration, and their ability to develop, you know, persistence and those kind of skills that are going to help them, you know, throughout their life, you know, knowing that, you know, they're not going to necessarily get that in the home setting. And part of that is also getting, you know, teachers and other school staff, you know, to recognize, you know, how important those things are for the kids, and how important it is for them to develop a caring, loving, nurturing relationship with kids, because sometimes that may be, you know, the one relationship that really helps them, you know, get through that tough period and be successful. I mean, you often hear stories of people that, you know, had a tough childhood, and they talk about, you know, one teacher or one mentor who really, you know, helped, you know, turn their life around. And teachers certainly have that, the capacity to do that. But the frustrating thing is that, you know, our schools, our public schools are making it more difficult for teachers to do that. They're really putting so much pressure on test scores, teachers are evaluated based on that they're really spending more time just wanting to make sure that they're teaching, you know, reading, writing, and math, as opposed to teaching life skills, which really kind of go hand in hand. But it's becoming very difficult, you know, for teachers to really, you know, have the overall impact that they could because of the way our public education system is, you know, moving in the direction it's moving. So, you know, that's very frustrating. And part of it with the parents who aren't engaged is, again, maybe finding a small way to get, you know, to get connected with them. And sometimes it's, you know, just, you know, making a phone call, a positive phone call. A lot of the parents who we have difficulty connecting with, it, you know, they probably had some difficult time in their lives, and maybe they had a difficult time in school as well. And you know, school has never really been something that's been, you know, looked at as important. But trying to connect with them and let them know that we know that, you know, that they're trying the best that they can and they're having a hard time, and you know, trying to find a way to connect with them and let them know that, you know, we're not, you know, being judgmental, that we want to try to be supportive, and we know that they're, you know, really trying the best they can, you know, to do things well for their family. But, you know, they might need a little support. And sometimes it's not a parent, it might be a grandparent or, you know, whoever it is that's really taking care of that, you know, child. But, you know, sometimes the caregivers, the only communication they get from the school is, you know, what their child is not doing right. You know, it's often phone calls about their child, you know, getting in trouble and making poor choices, and you know, and so there's more of a, you know, alienation between the school and the home. So what we really need to try to do is before those things happen, is to call the family and let them know what wonderful kids they have, you know, and what positive qualities we see in them, and really try to, you know, develop that relationship in that positive way, so that, you know, maybe down the road we can bring them in and then start to, you know, work on some of the tough changes that need to be made. But, you know, we're not always successful with that, but, you know.
No, I'm sure it's very, very, very difficult. A couple of the points that you made, I'd like to underscore.
Sure.
And this is true for all of our listeners. Whatever role you're in life, children are likely to pass you by or enter your life and come and go. And one adult can really make a difference in a child's life. We see that again and again. We see it in our own lives. We see it in the lives of people we treat. We see it in the lives of people who tell us their stories. How often one person, a coach, a teacher, a minister, a therapist, what a difference that person made. So take heart in that, and remember that, you know, with the metaphor of how there's so many starfish on the beach, you know, what good does it do to throw one or two back and, into the water so they can survive? Well, we can all really save an important starfish in our life a child by giving to children. I just think that's incredibly important. And another thing you're saying I think is incredibly important is how you approach the families in a positive way toward them, and you emphasize the positive qualities of the child. Both these are not in vogue in mental health right now. Neither the importance of an individual in the child's life is in vogue, nor are the other aspects we're talking about in vogue, such as emphasizing the good qualities of the kid. We're in really a tough situation. You know what? While you were talking, I was thinking back to 1968 when I was with the National Institute of Mental Health, Michael. I was for a year a part of a small group there called the Mental Health and Education Center. And back then, people who lived in the inner city and worked with inner city children were talking about it being a lost generation. They were feeling so frustrated and hopeless and heartless about the kids in the inner city. And I don't know that things are much better now. So your work is so incredibly important. What are you able to do within the school system? You've mentioned consulting with the teachers and encouraging them, reminding them of the importance of relationship. Do you do groups of the kids? Do you see them individually yourself? Do you encourage peer counseling? What are you doing in the school? Right. What are you able to do?
There's a variety of things. And again, you know, things have changed in terms of what I'm able to do in a school setting, you know, compared to when I started. But, you know,
Was it getting worse or better?
Well, I would say it's a little worse, but overall. But in terms of what I do, you know, I still try to make sure that, you know, I do the things that I know that are important, and you know, I try to make sure I do that. But it's harder to do that in today's school setting. But you know, I meet with kids individually. You know, sometimes I'll have a group at, you know, for lunch. And sometimes it's just to, you know, again, develop relationships or work on, you know, skills like, you know, turn taking. A lot of our kids coming into kindergarten don't know how to sit down and play like a game with a couple other kids, like how to take turns and how to be good sports, persons, you know, how to, you know, give, you know, feedback to each other. So, you know, sometimes I might just take a group of younger kids and, you know, play games with them, but then, you know, model and role play, you know, ways to handle, like, you're not always going to win the game, and so how do you handle that frustration or, you know, because as a young kid, you typically want to win. So some of those skills that they're not coming in with because they haven't had the opportunity prior to coming to kindergarten, you know, working on those skills. Myself and the social worker, I'm fortunate to have a wonderful social worker who, you know, we have a really good working relationship, and so she and I will do classroom meetings in all the classrooms here in our building, and during that 20 to 30 minutes, we just, you know, we really spend a lot of time talking to the kids about, you know, their qualities of greatness is what we call them, and we have them talk to each other about those things, and it's amazing to see how they respond to that opportunity where they can, you know, talk to each other, and they need a little support and help with that initially, but they catch on pretty quickly in terms of, you know, sharing with each other things that they noticed about, you know, a friend or a peer that they thought was wonderful, like somebody who, you know, helped them with an activity, or somebody who let them, you know, get in line in front of them, or somebody who helped, you know, clean up their, you know, papers that had spilled all over the floor. So, you know, really giving, you know, each other feedback about, you know, the qualities that they possess that are important. And so we talk a lot about those kind of things and in terms of their friends and themselves and then their families, and talk about how important they are, and in a way how really they're more important than what grade they got on a test, you know. So the feeling is that, you know, if you're a young student who can develop skills like persistence and determination and, you know, fearlessness and those kind of things, then, you know, you're going to do pretty well in school, because when you're faced with challenging tasks, you're not going to give up. You're going to, you know, you're going to try your hardest, and you're going to do the best that you can. So those skills are really important to have. And if you don't have those, then it's easy just to, when you're faced with some challenging work, to say, oh, I can't do this, or, you know, I'm not smart enough to do this, because of some other messages you've been told. So really trying to get them to understand that, you know, it's not necessarily about, you know, the grade you get or the score you get on a test. It's, you know, how did you handle it? How did you approach it? What kind of, you know, are you somebody who is really, you know, cooperating with other students in your class to work on a project and to learn things that way? So, and we don't do enough of that. And it's getting harder to even do those kind of things with our students, because there's so very little time for those kind of things, because of today's, you know, requirements, and even things like, you know, art, music, and gym. You know, again, those things have been significantly decreased in terms of the kids' exposure to those kind of things. And you know, as you know, I mean, kids, not all kids learn the same way. Not all kids can sit in a classroom for 6 hours, you know, staring at the front of the room, and pay attention. I mean, some kids need to move around. Some kids need to do, you know, need to work, you know, hands-on with stuff. So sometimes I'll have kids in here individually who just need a break from that, you know, typical classroom day, and they, you know, will work on a project together. Or, you know, we've had kids who are really good with their hands, and we'll give them things to take apart and try to put back together. You know, those are the kind of things that some kids, you know, need to do, but unfortunately they're often not given the opportunity to do that. So, you know, that's a lot of what I try to do, and try to do some seminars for, you know, other school staff. But in terms of school psychology, in terms of what I'm trying to communicate, it's much different than a lot of my colleagues, which also can be frustrating, because, you know, our national organization is talking to school psychologists as if we need to be, you know, the ones who first identify, you know, young kids who might have bipolar, so that we can get them the needed treatment, which means we need, you know, that we get them on medication, and even things like schizophrenia.
I think it was you got me invited to talk to the New York State school psychologists, and it's a disappointing group.
It is.
They really were just in the pocket of psychiatry. It's interesting because I think you also got me talking. You do a lot of good things. Got me talking with the BOCES group, in New York State, and they seem to be much more into the change and into looking at kids differently. What do you think is the difference between those teachers working in BOCES, and how would you describe BOCES? It's like the alternative school system in New York.
Right, and it's, you know, it depends on the district, but, you know, it is an alternative setting, and sometimes it's more related to job training. And sometimes it's just, you know, and so I think they might have a different perspective, because they see, you know, some kids who may not do well in a traditional setting, but who flourish, you know, as a mechanic or as a carpenter, those are important skills to have, you know, plumbers, and, you know, we need those, that workforce. But, you know, it's not that they can just do things with their hands, but they also have to have, you know, some understanding of math, but it's done in a different way. And instead of just, you know, trying to, you know, lecture to them about, you know, math and different things, you know, kids who are doing it with their hands and as part of something that's meaningful, you know, they're going to do much, you know, they're going to have more success with that kind of teaching than, you know, a lot of what we teach kids in the traditional setting, for most kids, doesn't have a lot of meaning, like why is this important? But if you're, you know, going to BOCES and learning carpentry and you're learning about math and measurement and those kind of things, you can see, you know, very clearly why it's important. So I think there is, you know, there's a different mindset there possibly, but, you know, in terms of school psychology, I think you're right. I think they've gotten too much information from, you know, filtered down from psychiatry,
right,
through, you know, even, you know, APA, the American Psychological Association. So they, you know, they go to workshops that talk about, childhood bipolar and, yeah. and brain scans, and that you can, you know,
yeah,
I was
right.
just having some, you know, dialogue on the new National Association of School Psychologists. They also have a listserv, and I was having some dialogue with them about, because somebody had mentioned that, you know, ADHD, you can see that on a brain scan, and that there's variations of it, and depending on which type of ADHD they have, they're going to be more successful on medication than not. And you know, that was mostly coming from a workshop that they had, you know, gone to by Russell Barkley. And if anybody knows, you know, the history of ADHD, we know Russell Barkley has been a big proponent of that. And and so they don't really
we got to go to break.
Okay.
When we come back, let's talk some about Russell Barkley. Let's talk about what kind of effects you feel you're having, and maybe individual kids that you're helping. And also let's talk about this larger question of how are we going to get the nation to view the schools differently if the testing is causing so much trouble. And we're talking with Michael Gilbert. He's in Syracuse, New York. He's a therapist in private practice, and he's a school psychologist. And we'll go to break and be back shortly. And this is Dr. Peter Bregan again on the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour. My guest, Michael Gilbert from Syracuse, New York. He's a PhD and a school psychologist. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Peter.
Keep in mind that we can talk about anything that you're interested in terms of... Are you at school?
I tried to mute that. Yes, I'm still at school.
That was the school...
announcement.
Intercom system announcement. Oh,
yeah.
It's going to give shivers to everybody imagining that being back in school again. It doesn't hurt a thing. It's a little color of the show. Gosh, as I'm talking to you, I go through a lot of different feelings, more so than with many other guests, about first, you know, how you're so pretty much alone among people I know, although you do have social work that you trust that you're working with, who's actually in the schools, in the inner city schools, working with poor families. And it makes so clear how the problems you're dealing with are ultimately so political in nature. There's so much about what in the world can we do to allow the flourishing of family life in these situations, and what can we do to redeem the schools as human institutions. And then my other thought is about the kids you are touching personally and stories about them, if that's something you could manage. So I give you the mic again to kind of go in one direction or another.
Yeah, well, maybe we can cover all that. I mean, in terms of, you know, the school systems, I mean, there are, you know, local, like state and national reform movements, but those things are slow. And as you alluded to, it's very political. So, you know, often what you hear is, you know, how our kids are not competing with, you know, the global, international, you know, in comparison to other countries, and how our kids are not being prepared for the 21st, you know, century, you know, world in terms of technology and stuff. And you know, a lot of that is very political because, you know, if you talk to people who really know, you know, the research and those international, you know, test scores, when you control for something like poverty, the United States actually does quite well in comparison to other countries. And so it's not necessarily that we're not, you know, preparing our kids, you know, to compete internationally. It's that we have a lot of poverty in our country. And you see that in different areas. And certainly, you know, where I am, there's a, you know, that's a significant issue. And that poverty, you know, presents a number of challenges, and including, as I kind of talked to you a little bit before about, you know, just growing up in a kind of a stressful environment. You know, poverty can be, you know, something that can cause a lot of stress to a family. And, it certainly impacts everybody, including the kids, and it often, you know, will manifest itself in the child's behavior. And, you know, certainly in a school setting where they're supposed to be very, you know, attentive and you know, in a certain way. So,
Michael, this is very, very important what you've just said. So let me pick you up on just one point. So in effect, I think what you're saying is if we compared the more affluent parts of the society and its schools, like in the Syracuse suburbs rather than the Syracuse inner city, we would be doing well in comparison to other countries?
Correct, yeah.
Boy, that's important, and I've never heard that before, and I was actually wondering about it as you were talking today and wondering if you had that information, and there you do. You got that information.
Yeah.
That is so important. So the problem isn't the one we're focusing on at all in terms of trying to uplift the whole boat. It's really about the people in poverty in this country who are getting being born shortchanged, the kids.
Exactly. And, I mean, even, and I don't know the exact date when they first started, you know, comparing international test scores, but typically the United States has never really been towards the top of the list. So, you know, but politically they make it sound like, you know, recently, you know, there's been a significant drop in terms of our scores in relation to other countries. But I believe if you went back and you looked at all the years when they first started, you know, implementing this comparison of countries, we've never really been towards the top of the list. I mean, I think we started out somewhere in the middle. You know, we have dropped a few places, but it's not as significant as they make it sound. And again, when you control for something like poverty, then we compare, you know, quite favorably to other countries. So I think it is an important distinction. And, you know, but because of, you know, how political it's become, you know, it's very difficult to really make, you know, necessary changes because, you know, there's so much money involved in the whole testing industry in terms of people who make the test and field, you know, field testing and those kind of things. There's a lot of money to be made and you know, developing the test, but then also developing the curriculum that, you know, helps schools do well on the test. So there's a lot of teaching to the test. And again, it's, so, you know, is it really something that's benefiting our kids? It's, you know, they're, you know, being taught how to memorize, you know, certain information that may not really be useful to them as they, you know, get out of school and into the real world. There was a video that I saw recently, and I won't be able to remember what the young lady's name was, but she was valedictorian of a high school, and she was giving her speech at graduation, and she basically made some amazing points about how she felt she wasn't prepared, you know, based on the education she was given, to really be successful out there in the real world. And she kind of talked about, you know, her experience in the school and what that was like, and that she really wasn't taught to be a critical thinker. She was really taught to memorize things and believe everything, you know, she was, you know, told in school. You know, and that's another thing I will tell my own kids is, you know, just because something is taught to you in school doesn't necessarily mean it's accurate. And so if you have questions, it's okay to be respectful in that, but you know, you can ask questions that maybe challenge some things that you might learn in schools. And that's, you know, that idea that, you know, we're developing critical thinkers, really what we're developing is kids to go along with, you know, to conform, to go along with what, you know, they're told to do and really not be critical thinkers, which I think is an important skill, you know, for young kids to learn. So we have a ways to go in that arena, but you know, working in the school district, that's something that, you know, I'm passionate about and spend a lot of time on. And I, you know, so for me personally, part of it is, you know, how do I you know, how do I operate in a system that's so severely flawed? And there's some things that I just I'm not going to be able to change. But how can I operate within that system and still do what I think is the right thing to do for kids? You know, and also, you know, maintain some level of, you know, my own sense of, you know, I'm doing some good work, and not just feeling like, you know, I can't be, you know, helpful to some of these kids. So it's a really it's a balancing act, and sometimes it's, you know, more difficult than others. But you know, I try to, you know, keep that in mind. You know, if there's a few kids that maybe, you know, I help, or there's some teachers that I, you know, help change the way they look at kids and perceive things, then, you know, then ultimately I think I am, you know, being successful in what I'm doing. And I've heard from other school psychologists across the country who often email me kind of offline from the listserv about how much they appreciate somebody speaking out and that they have similar, you know, views, and maybe they're even, you know, retired now or close to retirement, they've just kind of given up on trying to change the system because, you know, they've, you know, been unsuccessful as well. So so that's good to hear sometimes. You know, it kind of keeps you motivated to mm-hmm. to keep going.
Well, on a more positive note, too, I'm seeing tremendous changes in the people I talk to, the teachers, the families. By and large, psychologists, with the exception of some of the more entrenched professionals and professional groups, but just so much more positive attitude toward wanting more empathic, caring, engaging approaches, and much more acceptance of my critique and yours of psychiatric diagnosis and drugs. Are you seeing changes in that regard?
Some. I mean, you know, part of it just depends on, you know, which groups I might be talking to in general. But, you know, I think there are some changes. But I think, you know, the higher you go up the chain of, you know, the organization, it's maybe less so, because again, they're still really connected to other groups. And I think just a lot of it is where, you know, folks are getting, you know, some of their training, and also where they're going for workshops. I mean, part of the problem is, and when I do workshops with other school psychologists, I say, listen, I don't expect, and I don't want you to leave here just accepting everything I say as the truth. What I want you to do is I want you to take these resources and these references, and I want you to go and explore them and research them and digest them yourselves and decide what you think about this. Because what often happens is professionals will go to a workshop and they'll hear about brain scans and how you can diagnose bipolar, ADHD, or whatever it is with it, and they just believe it's true. They don't really challenge it. And so when I present something that's, you know, contradicts that, you know, it's sometimes hard. And because I'm not an MD, if they've heard it from a psychiatrist or someone like Russell Barkley, who's the, you know, the authoritative expert in that area, supposedly, they have a hard time with it. So for me, it's really getting them to really, you know, really research it more thoroughly. And my challenge to them is if you're going to talk with parents about things like bipolar and ADHD and medication, then you better go really learn it from all angles and not just the one that you think you know to be the correct way. Because these are families and these are kids, these are their lives that we're talking about. So it shouldn't be taken lightly, and they should really be critical and really, again, look at all the information that's out there that, you know, talks about a different perspective, you know, so that they can really, you know, make some better choices for themselves, I think, because I often find that that's what happens. And I think, you know, that's not just school psychologists. I think it's in a lot of areas, all the way, you know, through the media, where the media will just pick up on something and run with it and not really even investigate it thoroughly to see whether or not there are other, you know, plausible explanations for something. And you know that probably better than anybody.
yeah.
that they just, you know, they've gotten lazy in a way. You know, it's just like, oh, they hear something and they say, well, okay, that must be true because it's being reported as such, and they don't really, you know, investigate it in depth.
The whole neuroscience thing, Michael, is so important. I'm going to take a minute and address that because this comes up all the time. Somebody says there's an MRI or there's this research or there's that research. And it's really important for our listeners, especially those who aren't regular listeners, to re-emphasize that there are no known physical causes for any routine psychiatric diagnoses, even bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, certainly ADHD and the behavioral issues. There's simply nothing there. There's no genetics, there's no biochemistry, there's no biology. It's all made up in the service of trying to connect drugs to brain disorders. And even if someday one of these things turned out to be physical in some way or genetic in some way, which I theoretically doubt, there's no reason to believe that the toxic drugs we give to people would help that physical disorder. It would make it worse. And that simple logic is never presented. And, of course, my books, one after another, going back to toxic psychiatry and right up to my latest book, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, all, you know, present this data, as well as a lot of other folks' books now. So I just want to just keep reminding folks that neuroscience is, in the hands of psychiatry, is pseudoscience. When we don't know how a brain gets us to speak or think, when we don't know how a brain enables us to have thoughts and feelings, when we don't know the basic underlying functions of the brain, when we don't even have an Einstein or a Newton, or go back even earlier, we don't have any scientist of the brain who's explaining to us how it works, we don't know how it works. The only reason people go around saying it's a brain scan, it shows ADHD, is they're trying to sell you something, either psychiatric drugs in most of the cases, or in some cases supplements or some other cockamamie solution to a problem which is fundamentally educational, psychological, and social. The kids diagnosed with ADHD have myriad problems. Some of them are absolutely normal. Just too high expectations. Some of them are in boring classrooms. Some of them are coming from dysfunctional families. Some have a lot of anxiety about being in school. Some of them are hungry when they get to school. To call them ADHD is absolutely meaningless. There's no underlying such disorder known. So I just want to put that in because it's just so important not to get bamboozled by the mention of a brain scan.
Right, and even if you put that, you know, those theories aside, I mean, if you just look at what's considered, you know, I don't want to call it treatment, but, you know, if you look at the studies that talk about, you know, outcomes for use of various drugs, I mean, the outcomes are not good.
So, they're terrible.
So it's even equally important is that there's so many other things that could be done that are safe and effective, and they may require, you know, some work, though. And again, that goes back to, you know, one of the things that I struggle with is, you know, have we gotten to a point in, with our society that people just are no longer to really, you know, do the hard work they might need to do to change things for their families and for their kids because, you know, everything's about quick fixes and that's kind of the world we live in. Everything has to be quick and easy. And life's not that way.
No, it's not that way, and I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, parents have to be responsible for their children. Families have to be responsible for children. And schools need to be more responsible as well for the kind of work you're doing, which is helping your children learn to relate to each other and values. I don't know how you feel about that, Michael, but, you know, especially in these schools where the kids come in so poor and from such chaotic homes often, not always, but often, they could really use simple value lessons in school, but they're pretty much forbidden now, aren't they?
Yeah. Sorry, I thought they were going to come over the intercom again.
No, you, I'm just waiting for you to have a fire alarm. You have to tell me I'm sorry, I'm leaving.
Here it comes.
It's all right, Michael. You're adding a little reality to the show. This is what it's like, folks, to be a school psychologist. You don't get a moment to focus your own attention, it sounds like.
Yeah, I wish I could turn it off sometimes. So, we don't spend a lot of time on that, and I don't know if it's because it's not valued or just because there's a lot of things that go on. It's pretty complicated because, you have some teachers who feel that, school is about, education of the basic kind of, again, reading, writing, math, and that kind of stuff, and that, schools have become, where the expectation is that you're, taking kids, care of the kids, nutritional needs and their emotional needs and their nurturing them and then also trying to teach them the basic, academic skills. But for me, it's like it's hard for me to separate those things. Like, they're all interconnected. So as a teacher, you're really responsible for the whole child. And I think a lot of teachers feel that way, but things have changed so much that, a lot of teachers I talk to today, it's sad because teaching has become more of a job. It used to be a passion. Like, they really... really meant something to them, and now it's they kind of see it as a job, and it doesn't have the same passion, and then so you combine that with a child's natural curiosity and love of learning, and how we when they come into school we actually do things to kind of crush that. That combination is just not good for kids, it's difficult, to get, teachers, to feel passionate again about, why they, wanted to become a teacher in the first place, because, they're basically being told how to teach and what to teach and how long to teach it, and, that creativity that they might bring to it has been taken away. And when you look at other countries that are doing well, like Finland often gets looked at, the way that they view teachers is much different. They view teachers as very, alongside lawyers and doctors in terms of, their level of value. They don't necessarily get paid like lawyers and doctors, but they're seen as very important. And the other thing that they do differently is that they're given a framework of what they want schools to teach children, but then they allow the teachers, to develop their own kind of, curriculum within that framework, again, believing that they're the experts and they know what they need to do to teach kids those skills. They're kind of given more freedom to do that. And so you have more flexibility in terms of how you teach your day and how you handle different groups of kids who are learning in different types of ways.
Michael, before I forget, tell folks how they can get in touch with you, email, phone, anything you like.
Okay. A few ways. Our website is www.iacaf.org. They can call 315-382-0541. And they can email me directly at mgilbert, that's M-G-I-L-B-E-R-T, at iacaf.org.
Michael Gilbert, thank you very, very much for helping us with complex, difficult, frustrating, and important issues. I'm so glad to have you on the show. Thank you.
Peter, thank you anytime.